Yeah, it's nice to have you back. As a fact, a neighbor of Jim's upstate.
About 4 miles away from my house.
And I think you have a pretty tough job here moderating some questions, Graham. Good luck.
So actually, I'm not clear whether I have to moderate questions or ask questions. I've got 3 questions I can ask you. But if other people have questions, I'm happy to. There's someone with a mic who will go around. Let's go with the 3 questions. 1, globalization, all the people moving to cities. 2, is Detroit really our future? What was my third one? Las Vegas. Let's start with Las Vegas. The Venturis in the 60s, the Carmobile, the whole auto city thing. You remember it?
Yeah, it was cute gag.
Right.
You know, Robert Venturi.
My question. Oh. Okay. So now if you go back now, there's all these false city scenarios in the car parks. The cars are parked in the back. And what would happen if every American strip mall followed the same pattern?
Well, this has been the great hope of some of the new urbanists who had a pretty good program for retrofitting suburbia. The trouble is that the capital's not going to be there, and that's just, we can't afford to do that.
What I'm thinking about is, like, you're showing, they reproduce Venice, say. Mm. The image of Venice.
Well, that just comes from living in a cartoon culture where, you have 3-4 generations that have been subject to the depredations of television. And so, we think that the virtual is a good enough substitute for the authentic.
Okay.
Let me just finish this thought. Because one of the great lessons of the time is that the virtual is not an adequate substitute for the authentic. We haven't learned that yet.
But what about if we were able to create a new kind of urban form which we don't know yet? That when I go to Venice and I go there, I've been going the last 15 years, they complain about the 12 million tourists who go through every year, and that there's nobody really living in the center of Venice. It's impossible to have a school there. Of course, with pram pushing kids around is hard, blah, blah, blah. And there's a whole evacuation to Mare Street because you have a modern city there where you can have a car also. Okay. So what about this, when we go to Amsterdam, we love it. When I go to Copenhagen, I love it. When I go to Stockholm, I love it. But, and actually we were talking before, Stockholm, they actually have a program to have the university in the city. They have the old people's housing in the city. They have regular people in the city, but it's a deliberate program.
Yeah. Well, actually, what you're describing about Venice is not a problem of physical form. It's a programming problem.
Well, do you think New York has the same problem?
It's a programming problem because the economy of the late 20th century supported abnormal flows of tourism. What we're going to see is that the age of Europe as the universal theme park is coming to an end. Look at, the character of regions of the world changes hugely from age to age. In our parents' generation, Europe was a charnel house, it was a bloodbath. And in our time, it was exactly the opposite. It was a wonderful theme park. But Europe is now entering an economic convulsion of its own. My own opinion is that it's going to be a much more disorderly place politically and economically than it has been for the last 40, 50 years. And that's about to happen. We're certainly seeing it begin to happen in places like Greece. And Cairo is not in Europe, but it is one of those tourist destinations in the region. So that's a programming problem. It's not, the physical form of Venice, apart from its water problems, is great. People love it. I think one of the larger problems, if you can call it that, is simply that, in the world, there are not that many great places that people feel wonderful in. In America, this astounding thing about America is that you get all these wealthy people from Minnesota and Illinois and Ohio and Arkansas, God knows what. And they go to Europe, and they sit in the squares, and they drink the, you know, drink pastis in the cafe, you know. And they love being in this, you know, that's their vacation. They go there to relax. And then they go home back to Illinois and Minnesota, and they do every fool thing possible to destroy their towns. You know, they widen the road another two lanes, and they invite four more big box stores in so they can get the rateable, you know, taxes. You know, so I think we're pretty confused about that. So, you know, one of the results of that is we have almost no places in America that people really feel comfortable in. And, you know, and they'll all go to Europe to feel comfortable, and then they're overwhelmed with tourists.
What about Saratoga?
Saratoga is the only town it's the only town that is economically thriving in this vast area of desolation, you know, that's become Kazakhstan meets The Walking Dead.
Well, why is that?
Well, it's part of it is situational. It's actually the fourth wheel on the three-city capital district of upstate New York, which is composed of the capital of Albany, the industrial city, of Schenectady, and ditto Troy. These were the three cities of that district. They all failed, and then when they failed, all the people who lived in the area who had a decent job wanted to move to Saratoga because it was the only place that had any vitality, and they did.
So, no, I got another theory here. It was the party place, and actually, you had a big deal in that. Because you...
I threw a lot of parties.
You threw a lot of parties. But also, you had that newspaper, what was it, Civilian?
Civitas.
Civitas. And you lobbied to rebuild the Main Street, Broadway.
Yeah. Well, pound for pound, Saratoga Springs, New York, got more new buildings than any other city its size. Its size, by the way, is about 28,000. And we got about, 14 new buildings in Saratoga Springs. Virtually all of them had apartments in them, so they got a lot of live bodies downtown. And they even went through a very interesting transition where after 2008, there were still like five or six buildings that were permitted and approved for being built. And they made the wise decision to abandon the condominium model of ownership and to turn them into rentals. And they did it seamlessly. And
they took the strip malls and they took the Grand Unions and made like 8-story buildings, right?
They were 6-story buildings. And then, of course, you know.
This is like me talking about Las Vegas.
Not really. No, the scale of Las Vegas is
totally out. In a way, they flipped it from the strip mall, which was the Las Vegas model from before, to the dense urban model that we all love, right?
Yeah.
And it is it's still got Wilton Mall and all that other terrible stuff outside. Anyway, we should get a real question.
Yeah, but the trouble with Las Vegas, of course, is that the dimensions are so pharaonic. You know, they're so vast, and of course, the climate isn't really very nice. So going from Caesar's Palace to the Venice is like the Bataan Death March.
Okay. Well, what about Detroit, just while I've got my last...
Detroit's already been through its period of
disinvestment. Is that our future?
Well, it's the present.
And is that going to be the future of American cities?
Well, it's the future and the present of a lot of them. And I got a letter this week from a guy who said, I was in St. Louis this week. I think he might have been in there for the baseball playoffs. I'm not sure. He said, I was in St. Louis this week. And I'm from the Midwest, and I can't believe what bad shape that town is in. It's getting to be just like Detroit. So, you know, this process of disinvestment is a form of cancer. However, you know, it has engendered a lot of bad thinking. One of the thoughts that is now popular about Detroit is, we'll turn Detroit into farms, you know? That just shows, once again, you know, this typological confusion. The urban design people no longer know the difference between what is rural and what is urban. They're going to put the farm in the middle of where the city is. And these cities occupy important sites that are geographically important. The reason that the old center of Detroit is where it is because it's on a river between two great lakes. You know, it's a strategically very important site and commercially a very important site. You know, the time will come when a settlement is going to be back in that part of Detroit, and you know, it will be a mixed use settlement where a lot of stuff happens, but people have a hard time seeing that right now. They have a hard time seeing the desolation, and you know, they'll just have to be patient.
Well, what, Detroit's gigantic. What about the Hudson Valley? We live in the, did you ever hear this thing, the food shed?
Yeah, sure.
We live in the food shed. Did you know that?
Yeah, because we produce a considerable amount of food up there
that
in Washington County, New York.
Down to the markets here.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a whole model, if you go to Asia, where they call it the Desikoto model, which means the village-city model, where the food is actually produced within the network of the city. And some people think that's the future for, I know you're gonna have a hard time with this one, the suburbs, that, you know, that could, and so Detroit is a kind of model where maybe you could actually, you know, it's the size of Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and New York combined, Detroit.
Well, there are a number of problems with turning the farms, suburbs into that kind of situation in America. You know, one of them is that we have no idea how politically disorderly the country is going to be. And if that's the case, the suburbs are going to be a very hard place to do this. You know, there are many ways of doing the food growing system within the context of the town and the city. Some of them are ways that we haven't seen for a long time. One marvelous way, by the way, existed for a time in Paris, and it was the urban gardening system in Paris, where on fairly small lots you've got very concentrated.
There's
still remnants of vineyards there, but they grew all kinds of market and table vegetables in these gardens. The trouble was that at the end of the 19th century, the real estate value in the center of Paris became so high that it could no longer support that kind of use. The main thing, though, is that, you know, where food production is concerned, at least in our culture, there's a place to do the farming. It's called the hinterlands of the urban place. The hinterland, that's where you grow the stuff. It's pretty simple. Outside of town is where you grow stuff. You can still have gardens in the city. You can have dooryard gardens, rooftop gardens, community gardens, all kinds of gardens. But in the city, in the town, you get gardening, and outside of the town, you get farming, and they're not the same thing. So we sort of got to get our heads straight on about what that's about, and we're not. Anything from out there?
Yes, well, lots of, I don't know, how do you do this, Kevin?
Well, in a situation, say like Middle Island, Long Island, where you have...
You got a mic on your way.
Thank you, Justin. So in a situation like Mid Island, Long Island, where you have a kind of medium density suburb, you have very fertile land, you have a lot of reasonable water resources available, you don't have to irrigate out there. Would it be possible that this is a model for where suburbia can be retrofitted into a more productive agricultural entity?
I think it's a combination of, there's a theoretical model in our minds based on what we think right now about what's going on. But I think that that model is pretty flawed, because I think that most of the thought that passes for thinking among the thinking classes in America, and especially the building classes, I think that it's highly wishful and unrealistic. And I think that Long Island is going to be an especially disorderly place for the simple geographic reason that it's a dead end. You know, you really can't sort of get out of there once you're trapped there. And I think that in the immortal words of Tony Soprano, forget about it. Sorry. You know, I think there'll be efforts made to do it. There will be parts of Long Island that, you know, that they'll try to make it coherent. But I think that there's going to be such a loss of value in the infrastructure of Long Island that it will be a particular extreme example of the problems that you'll see in other places like the Chicago suburbs, the Minneapolis suburbs, etc. The places where, you know, you're not trapped. You know, you're not trapped like a rat on a, you know, on a spit of land that you can't get off of.
They have the LIRR, as a linear city.
They did, that's true, but you know, I'll stick by what I say. I think it's a fantasy.
Let's get another question.
Yes, I've heard a lot about, heard you speak a lot about the architecture of suburbia and potential solutions. But I don't really see any solution. I don't know how you're going to go from a population of 7 billion down to a population of 2 billion, which is what the Earth could reasonably sustain in farmland ratio to human population. The only reason there's 7 billion people here is because of oil, plain and simple. When the oil starts to run out, the economy will shut down in free fall, and everyone will be unemployed. New Yorkers will start eating each other in 60 days. I say this as a New Yorker. I live on 72nd Street. You know, I'm moving my family to Norway. We're going very soon. Norway has a very low population compared to farmlands. They have a well-established tradition of an agricultural society. They still have thousands, millions of sheep running around. So that's what I'm doing. I think the fracking is going to is ruining all of the clean water. When the shit hits the fan, mostly what we'll be concerned with is clean water. Do you have any golden mix that you would see as a place to look for? Like a population to geography to water source?
Well, like I said, I think that there are a lot of undervalued places in North America today, and many of them are located on the great inland waterways of America. Plenty of places in the Ohio River, the Missouri River, the Mississippi River, the Great Lakes. I think the Great Lakes is hugely undervalued. It's like the North American Mediterranean freshwater sea. You know, it's surrounded by great agricultural land. It may even become, you know, some of the more northerly parts of it might become better agricultural land if we have the kind of climate trends that we know about. So I think the Great Lakes are hugely undervalued. You know, we look at them now. We look at Detroit and Sheboygan and you know, those miserable little old boating towns on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I've been there. You know, it's like the day the Earth stood still up there. But you know, I think the places like that are going to have tremendous value. The places that I think are going to be hugely troubled are Dixieland. I think it's, you know, the fate of Dixieland is to become once again, you know, an agricultural backwater if it's lucky, you know, and that's basically the wet part of the southeast, of the south, of the Sun Belt. And then, of course, you know, the southwest, Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas, etc. Very troubled. You know, the thing about Dixieland, which I have a special animus about, for some reason. I made it the center of my third World Made by Hand novel, which just came out. And in the story, I've contrived to depict this new breakaway nation composed of Tennessee, Kentucky, the Carolinas, Virginia, Arkansas. They call themselves the Foxfire Republic. And they're led by a former TV evangelist and country singer. A lady who I call Dolly Parton meets Hitler. You know, I think the cultural infrastructure of Dixieland is going to be so challenging, you know, especially, you know, what was called cracker culture, which is an extremely pugnacious, you know, way, it's a social system, way of dealing with other people. And right now, I have actually correspondents in the South who live in, you know, 40 miles outside of Birmingham, Alabama, and other places. The stuff they write me about the behavior of their neighbors is just out of this world. You know, these are people who no longer have any boundaries left whatsoever. They don't, you know, they'll have sex with anything. You know, their stepdaughter, a dust mop, a Buick. You know, no boundaries at all. No, you know, they can't manage their money to save their life. You know, they can't manage their appetites. They can't manage drugs. They're lost. And, you know, so I think that that's going to be very, very troubled.
Okay, let's have a something
further. I have one of the first hand.
Where's my, well, I don't know.
The fact that you sit here and talk about.
Give that man a mic.
Yeah, give him a mic.
Detroit, you didn't bring the mic back.
Hold on, they're coming, they're coming.
Bring the mic over there.
They're coming.
I know.
Do you want to come after me, or do you want to come before me?
Let's go to the back. He's first-hand, as he said.
Actually, it's more of a comment. I find it very disingenuous, some of the things that you're saying, particularly about, you know, how you're saying reality and truth. And, you know, let me preface this by saying I'm not as intellectual as you are, but the fact that you're fear-mongering a lot of people without even talking about some of the real social dynamics that affect the cultural problem we're dealing with today, like putting the kid up there on the screen who are now a culture or accepting a new culture that you, yourself, how old are you, sir? I don't even know, but you're way older than me.
I'm way older than the elderly gentleman.
You have a school of thought that has been brought up upon a disenfranchisement of a particular group or ethnicity of people in this country. And this is supposed to be about sustainable design. And even in your own rhetoric and crap and shit throwing like a primate or something, on other people that you really don't have any relationship with, and only because of this privileged setting that you can talk to other up-and-coming graduate students who don't know their ass from their elbow because they're not really involved with some of the social dynamics that are really taking place. Like, I'm a regular person like that, working-class person, and people in Alabama, or in Detroit particularly, where the labor force, 62% of it is African-American, which is not just going down or having a bad economy because of people not knowing what to do or how to manage their money, or because intellectuals or white real estate people or people who had garnered their wealth because of slavery and disenfranchising a whole group of people like Saratoga Springs, New York, a group of people that made billions of dollars off of people from urban communities, black and brown kids that they've been incarcerated for the war on drugs for the last 40 years. So it really behooves me. And it's so disingenuous when I come to these places and listen to intellectuals talk about sustainable design and talk about reality and honesty and not even willing to be honest with yourself about the privilege that you now hold in this position, even in places like Saratoga Springs or a whole population of people that you want to acknowledge and identify who are have for more. And it's just modern stuff within the last 50 years has been doing more things to try to address this problem, providing more real-life solutions on how to actually address the issues, but you're here fear-mongering. So it's more of a comment. It's just so disingenuous. I just want to say that. So
okay. Thank you.
Been here in the last 5 years. There are people who have been here for three generations. People who are neurosurgeons, people who helped to build the MTA system.
Other people should be able to have the right to speak as well.
The Bronx is a farmland.
Please.
In 30 years, these intellectuals have told people that the city is bad. You can't plant the ground. It was owned by one person. When it was viable,
Please.
For intellectuals to benefit for themselves, they would do it. But now they're making people afraid because they don't want to re-empower the people they disenfranchise. This is not something about climate or how the system is breaking. Their intellectual system is breaking. And the more that you entertain this, the more that you'll accept their downfall. You're going down with them. That's because they refuse to acknowledge and re-empower the people they disenfranchise.
Okay,
please.
This is the Great Hall.
It's
the Great Hall. Everybody's entitled to a voice.
Well, it's good to know that Professor Irwin Corey is still alive and well.
Is that Irwin Corey?
I have the mic.
Yeah.
Here.
Okay. Great, thank you. Oh,
I actually think that commentary was relevant in an interesting way up to a point, certainly. And in a way, I don't know quite how to articulate this. First, it has the first thought was that there's another kind of globalism having to do with media, right, internet, and so forth, which is trying to be monetized, but it's not being 100% successfully monetized. And you could say, do we pull the plug on that as well, in the, you know, loss of the global exchange economy? So the fact that there's a media connection means, in a way, that maybe there isn't a way in which globalism would disappear. But connected with that is a tonal problem, in a sense, and it doesn't have anything to do with sensationalism or anything. It has to do with how close the return to the village in new urbanism, or the return to the small town values, or the return to the farm and the rural and the urban distinction, and many of the really very sharp, interesting, and provocative observations that you made are very close also to what we know historically to be a kind of fundamentalism. And that, how you, or libertarianism that is heading in the direction of a sort of fundamentalism. It's not that I totally, buy into all of your observations, obviously, because they're astute and they're insightful. And so, of course, we make that differentiation, but we know that small towns were the place in which extremely fundamentalist values were formulated and were responsible for blah, blah, blah. And so I just don't know quite how you strip away the skyscraper and the...
I think you'll find plenty of fundamentalist values in Dallas and Houston and Phoenix and Las Vegas. And you don't need a small town.
That's true. I'm saying is I find fundamentalist values in your recommendations.
Well, potentially. I'm not a fundamentalist. I actually was raised in a religion-free household, and I don't have any particular religious brief.
I'm not speaking in religious terms.
Would you say you're radical?
I'm a registered Democrat.
Are you a radical? Would you say?
Well, I'm off the reservation of conventional thought in my culture, but I don't consider myself to be a nut. So but other people can. I mean, I offer my thoughts to you for what you take them to be. There you have it.
Where's the mic now? Sorry. Somewhere there's one behind you on the left. Sorry. There's a lot of questions.
Sorry? I can talk about a mic. What are the institutions and organizations that we need to support more fully in this country, and which are the ones that we need to actively try and dismantle?
Well, good question. I'd say that as a general proposition, we're probably going to have to form a more of an institutional infrastructure locally. It's mostly absent, even in the cities that are fairly big. Places like Syracuse and Buffalo and Dayton. They've lost a lot of their, not just their political infrastructure, but their civic infrastructure. So that's going to have to be rebuilt. I will give you a very concrete example of something, though, that has been a terrible crime and a shame and a disgrace for our culture, especially for politically progressive people. For example, I voted for Barack Obama twice, okay? The Citizens United case that came up in the Supreme Court, which determined that corporations were the equivalent of people and ought to be able to express their political views through giving as much money as possible, okay? I would like to know why Barack Obama or the Democratic leadership in Congress, in the Senate in particular, didn't work on and introduce legislation or a constitutional amendment to redefine what the personhood of a corporation is, and why we're not even having a conversation about that in an election year. The omission of that, and the fact that intelligent, educated people are not having a conversation, are not demanding, why didn't we demand that Nancy Pelosi come up with legislation to redefine the personhood of a corporation? It's disgraceful. I think it's disgraceful that we had, 6 years of Eric Holder not prosecuting one Wall Street banker, not one. And now he's gone.
That speaks to really the point of my question, is whether or not showing up to vote has the capacity to actually
Well, I mean, a lot of people sort of bring up Amtrak as a whipping boy, but the fact is, it's not mandated, it's not written anywhere in stone that Amtrak has to be the company that runs the railroad system, or that, you know, there can't be many companies, or it can't be, you know, or the government can't be managed part of it, or, you know, there's many ways that you could do that. As far as voting is concerned, you know, I think the time is going to come when we'll have an election year that will be a shocking election. It might be 2014, and it might be a month from now when, you know, a lot of people are shocked to get voted out of office. You know, I know that there is somewhat of a movement for that. I think people were surprised in that one primary election that Eric Cantor got voted down. And, you know, we need to see more of that. Otherwise, you know, we're going to see political upheaval and, you know, non-election political expression. And that time will come. If, you know, there are criticalities there. There are thresholds. You know, to some extent, the contentment or the patience of the public, you know, is like the snowpack on the mountain. When that last snowflake falls, you know, there's going to be an avalanche, and it's liable to be ugly the longer that we put off engaging.
Okay.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Picks up where you just left off, actually. And that is that, you know, I see the plausibility of about 80%, I think, of what you're presenting here, and maybe more. But if it's half right, you know, what are the implications as regards social upheaval that get us? I mean, what has to happen between where we are now, or what's probably going to happen between where we are now and the more localized economy and the, you know, the return to the small town and the vision of the future that you're presenting. In a world where, I mean, we've seen through history how civilizations collapse, and at some point, social unrest leads to the collapse of civilizations. And is there an orderly path? I mean, what happens between where you are and the future that you see?
Well, I think what you actually get is different kinds and levels of disorder. And I think probably the person who's created the best model for this is a writer named Dmitry Orlov, who published several wonderful books. He's a wonderful, wonderful writer. Grew up in the old Soviet Union. His parents were let out in the 70s under some kind of a treaty that got a certain number of people out. And he was came to America and went to high school in America. And then as an adult went back to Russia just before and during and after the fall of the Soviet Union and worked in IT there. And he lives in the USA now for the most part, but he's written several books, and his most recent one is called The Five Stages of Collapse, in which he describes, you know, the first one being financial collapse, which is essentially the banking system and the way that anybody gets paid and makes a living. Second one is commercial collapse. That's things like the groceries, you know, the food getting to the supermarkets before the shelves are empty. Social collapse, et cetera, down the line. I think that his probably greatest insight, and he's not alone in this, is understanding that the weakest link of all the systems that we have is the financial system. Because the financial system of all the mega systems that are part of our, or the systems that are part of the matrix of our mega system, it is the most abstract. It's the one that most dependent on people's faith in the transactions that are, you know, going on. Is the dollar worth, you know, what it pretends to be worth? Well, it requires my faith and the faith of all of us, a consensus that that's true. And so, I agree with him that the financial system is the system liable to get in the most trouble first and to cause the most mischief, because a lot of people aren't going to get paid, or they're going to lose what they thought was their wealth, you know, their pension fund, their savings, one thing or another. That's the first thing to watch out for. Beyond that, it's hard to predict, you know, exactly what kind of events occur and how things unravel. I think we all hope that we're not living in a time of turmoil. Nobody wants that. I'm not advocating that. But if we're not psychologically prepared for that as an outcome, you know, we could just be blindsided and sleepwalk into it. Because right now we're sleepwalking into the future.
Okay, there's three people over here.
Let's take a couple more, Graham. Okay?
Yeah.
In the back here, the lady.
Okay. I just
there's a mic, sorry, coming your way. And
I enjoyed your talk. I wanted to just make a comment and ask you to comment on it. The divestment of the people who can afford it, and in the big box stores and corporations like that. That's what I see as a solution.
You mean?
You know, we live on the Delaware River. We live up in a small town, and I just see this vicious cycle of the community of the towns just breaking down because people can't afford to run a business, and the people in the community can't afford to go to the businesses. The people who are trying to run the business can't make enough money, so they end up going to Walmart. It's just this vicious cycle. The kids go to work. I'm an educator, so you know the kids go to work in these god-awful environments, and they start getting involved with drugs. It's a vicious cycle. You know, they overeat. You know, there's depression. Blah 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 blah. So, you know, how do we get rid of? I mean, the same way that 350.org is trying to encourage people to divest who can afford it from fossil fuels, and trying to urge organizations to do that. And the same thing I think needs to happen with these corporations. So, just please comment on that.
Well, as I said, I don't think that this particular model of trade is a permanent part of the human condition. Societies are essentially emergent organisms. They are emergent, self-organizing organisms. And cities are organisms. At their best, they're integral organisms that contain all of the organs of civilized life. You know, the educational organs, the residential organs, the commercial organs, the civic organs, etc. Because societies are essentially emergent, I think that the way this is going to work, play out, is it will be an emergent playing out. The commercial dynamics, the dynamics of trade that develop will emerge according to the circumstances and conditions that reality will present to us. For example, if we see a complete breakdown in the ability of Middle Eastern nations to govern themselves, which seems to be underway now, you know, with Syria, really just about everything there. The one thing that hasn't happened is we haven't seen a lot of disorder in Saudi Arabia, but the potential for that is enormous with ISIS, you know, just a few miles away, and with, King Abdullah being 90 years old and hardly ever being seen, and some people aren't even sure he's alive. So Saudi Arabia, tremendous trouble. So, you know, if that part of the world becomes too disorderly to even produce the amounts of oil that they have been, that's going to affect the way trade works. That's going to affect the 12,000-mile supply line between the factories in Guangzhou and the Walmart in Philadelphia. And, you know, we'll just have to make other arrangements. And people will. You know, the people are resilient and ingenious in that way. They, you know, if the 12,000-mile supply line fails and products and things are not getting to where they used to, they'll find other ways to do it and make a buck doing it. We may have less stuff to buy. I think that, you know, one of the features of the future is that shopping is going to retreat more into the background of life than it has been. You know, it's been in the forefront of everything for the last 25 years. you know. But it's gonna be, there are other things will be more, will take more of our attention. So that's my basic answer. Societies are emergent, self-organizing, and they will respond to the circumstances that reality presents.
Okay, last question. I don't know, it's someone over here, yes. Okay, so.
What should we be teaching our young people, whether it's in grade school, high school, colleges and universities like the Cooper Union? What should we be teaching at the architecture schools and the design schools?
The architecture schools, I'm sorry to say, are a little bit hopeless at the moment. They're basically being taught to perform stunts that are, you know, techno-narcissistic stunts. Look at me, I'm a special wizard genius, unlike you mortals. And I should get paid $5 million for being an uber wizard genius. And in the meantime, where's my chair at Harvard so I can teach shopping? That's what Rem Koolhaas did. You know, he was so hot, you know, 10 years ago that Harvard offered him a chair, a professorship, an endowed professorship. And then they said, what do you think you're going to teach? And of course, you know, he was a prankster, so he said, oh, I'm going to teach shopping. Basically, what he was saying was, bend over and pick up the soap, Harvard. I'm going to give it to you good and hard. That's architectural education. Today, and so we're performing techno stunts to show that how we can tweak surfaces and create all sorts of marvelous claddings with strange undulations. You know, none of those buildings are going to be fixed or renovated, including the one across the street. And it's unfortunate. It's tragic. But I have to add, I think that the whole infrastructure of education in America is going to contract, like everything else, it's going to have to get smaller. You know, many big institutions are going to shrink. Probably a lot of state university campuses are going to close down. We're going to have far fewer people in higher education, and probably more people learning practical things that will make them, allow them to be useful to their fellow man. It's going to present a lot of changes that people aren't going to like, you know. But the prospect of not working in the marketing department of the Gap, but instead having to be, you know, the manager of a 5-acre farm, you know, we're going to see things like that. Those will be some of the choices for kids in the future that are going to surprise them. So, I guess that's about it. Thanks for coming.